history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty amazing stories waiting to be heard. All it takes is time, a little curiosity, and the willingness to listen. We want our veterans to know we appreciate their service and sacrifice, and that we're not going to forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we listen to their stories, we're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up gleaning some inspiration as well. We're going to meet a pair of 93-year-olds today. They live on opposite sides of the country, and though they both served in the Army Air Corps in World War II, they had very, very different experiences. One was shot down in the skies over Europe. The other never saw combat. They both have reason to believe they've been living on borrowed time for quite a while, and they've both found ways to make their time count. We're going to start with Roy Cotner of Sanger, California, also known as the nation's Christmas tree city because of the famed General Grant tree in the nearby Sequoia National Forest. And trees will have a lot to do with what we hear about Roy's story. We're sitting right next to an orange grove. I think I saw a sheep out there. This is country living, and you've been living that life for a long, long time, haven't you, Roy?
I've been here about getting close to 90 years now.
What do you remember about your childhood out here?
I grew up down here at the corner of Belmont and Trimmer Springs Road, that big two-story house there. That belonged to George Hume, Hume Lake. He's one to put
Lumber flume?
The flume all the way down. It went right down. This is Flume Road here.
Where we're sitting is right next to the famed lumber flume that brought logs down from the mountains here all the way to the valley floor. And George Hume, who you just mentioned, is the namesake of Hume Lake, which is very popular now that the Christian camp there draws thousands every year. So you knew Mr. Hume.
I knew him. My dad had bought both sides of Hume's place. And he wanted that place real bad because it had a nice house on it. He called Mr. Hume up. He knew him. He said, yes, I'll sell it. So the next time it came out, well, my dad and him agreed on the price. He paid $10,000 for that 10 acres and the house. And that's how we got all this 70-some acres in a line here.
And this is acreage that you are still working on. You're 93 years old, but you still get out there in the tractor? And what do you do?
Oh, yeah, I check water. I got a golf cart. You know, we have mister systems now in the orchard, so we drive every other row, and you can look both sides and see that both of them and misters are working. If something's wrong when they're plugged up, you got to get off and fix them.
Well, a lot of guys, when they're your age, they say, I'm going to let somebody else do that. Why is it important to you to continue being involved that way?
Well, I like to see them get ahead here, so I'm helping them out. I don't get paid or anything.
Yeah.
Well, I do. I get a share.
Well, and your impact on the tree fruit industry is pretty interesting, too, and we're going to talk about that before we're done. But I'm interested in your childhood. You're out here on the ranch. Were you guys working from a real young age? Did you have a whole bunch of chores to do with this acreage?
When we were kids, the Chinese had the ranch before, and they let it go. There was Bermuda grass all around the trees. Well, my brother and I, it was our job. When we got home from school, we had to go out and dig out the Bermuda around most of the trees, you know, as we every day almost.
And that's not easy because those tentacles go everywhere at Bermuda.
They sure do. When I was in the eighth grade, I had a little .22 rifle. It was automatic, just a little short thing, and all those kids would run around. We all had .22s. We'd go shoot at my cousin's place, shoot into the lumber wood pile and everything. So my aunt called us in for lunch. So we all go inside, and I take my little rifle, and I set it down and lean it on me. And my little four-year-old cousin, he waddles over there, and he pulls the trigger on my rifle. I left a bullet in there, and I got shot in my stomach here, right below the navel. It made an arc and just missed my heart, and it was still under the skin right here, the bullet. That night, I had an operation, and my dad, after the operation, he went down to the pool hall to have a beer, I guess. And who do you think was in there? The assistant doctor. And he was telling the group of people there that that boy got shot in the stomach. He didn't have a chance. But I made it through it.
Wow.
So anyway, get back to the Army. When I got to Macon, Georgia, from San Antonio after basic, they made an outfit. We were going to be in the 8th Air Force. We got a call to go to Florida, at the lower part of Florida. But they used to send busloads down, and I was the last one left. So I had to do the morning report and everything. After about 3 days, I never got any call to go or anything. So I went to the commanding officer and I find out what the problem was. Well, he says, let me get your records. So he got my records and looked at it. Well, he says, you got you down here as 4F. I says, 4F? And I knew what they were talking about. So I says, well, I played football 3 years in high school. I've worked for a year for the government, and I'm still 4F. Well, he says, strip your clothes down and let me check you out. So I just took my clothes off and he checked me out. He pushed around on me here and there. Well, you've been that long, so I'll take you off 4F. So I got to join the group down in the lower part of Florida. And our job was putting in cannons and B-25s to send to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And about half of our group had to go there, but I never did have to go. After that, I went to northern Florida at Avon Park. That was a B-17 training base. We had a lot of work because these guys wouldn't land just right, and my wingtips were real bad. So,
well, I want to ask you some questions about that.
Sure.
But first, on the 4F thing, so for, you know, maybe some of the younger people listening, they don't understand what 4F means. Basically, it means you're physically disqualified from serving.
Yeah.
And it was because of the bullet wound from when you're an eighth grader?
Yeah.
When your cousin accidentally shot you in the stomach?
Yeah.
You had been classified 4F, but you weren't aware of that.
I wasn't aware of it.
So after you finished high school, you went and took a class, a month-long class, to learn how to fix airplane engines?
Yeah, no, metalwork, wings, whatever.
Uh-huh. And because of that class, you got a job in Sacramento at the Air Depot.
That's right. McClellan Air Base was right next to it. Our job was, or the job I had anyway, was putting bulletproof fuel tanks in the wings.
Mm-hmm.
They were made where you could unscrew the top part and you drop them in, and you'd have to test them and see if there was no leaks or anything like that. I was good at doing forming of aluminum, making the leading edges on the wings and stuff like that. When I got drafted, my foreman gave me a letter of recommendation to go into the Air Force.
Yeah, so you'd already been part of the war effort, working as a civilian on those planes in Sacramento, but now you're drafted into the service. You mentioned that confusion about whether or not you were 4F because of the childhood injury, but now you end up in Florida reconfiguring B-25s by adding cannons in the nose to prepare them for North Africa?
I had to reinforce the structure of the plane to hold the cannons.
Mm.
But the pilot said that when they fired those cannons off, the airplane would just kind of shudder a little bit, you know.
I bet.
They were for shooting the tanks over there. From there, I went up to Avon Park, and I finished the year out at a B-17 training base, repairing them.
Uh-huh.
Two of them, it was pretty bad, but were fixable. We took two and made one out of it.
Sure, yeah.
So
cannibalized one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
You get that beat-up plane, and you have to make it airworthy again. How does that work? What do you do?
Well, you just start tearing parts off and taking the other ones and put on. Really nothing to it.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a little common sense. That's the same thing I did when I went overseas. I lucked out. I went to 13th Replacement Depot. I got assigned right there at Wheeler Field, right next to Schofield.
That's on the island of Oahu, of course, and Wheeler Field is one of the American installations that was hit by the Japanese on December 7th, 1941. And I bet you saw some pretty fresh evidence of that when you got there in late 1943.
Our buildings were just loaded with or the 50 caliber shells that hit the bank, and they never tried to repair them.
You can still find those bullet holes there today.
Did they leave them in those buildings? I thought I wanted to kind of go there and look around.
Of all the planes that you worked on, did you have a favorite?
My favorite actually was B-25 because we had it one ourselves there. Our headquarters was in Hilo on the other island. And every Saturday, our commanding officer wanted to get his flight pay, so he would go there. Well, once in a while, I'd get to crew his plane, or I'd ride with a crew boss. And the funny part was, one day, we were ready to go, and already had the engines going. We got some extra guests that wanted to go. So we had to send for more parachutes. So they called down, and here he comes with a tug with three or four more parachutes. And I'm at the bay window catching them as they throw them up. the last damn parachute. Somehow or other, I grabbed it in the wrong place, and I popped that ripcord, and my parachute pops open. And the colonel comes back, and he says, Cotner, he says, I don't mind the parachute, but he says, gas is hard to get.
So you were on Oahu when Japan surrendered.
Right. I got to march in the Victory in Europe parade on Honolulu and also at the Japanese surrender. After the war was over, a fleet of B-24s, we had to recondition them. There must have been 20 or so. If they needed new engines, they got new engines. And we repaired any metalwork that had to be done. And who do you think got them? Chinese got them. And the funny part is, they wanted someone to fly with them all the time when they're... I was designated to do that, so I arrived with all these Chinese, and what they do, they saw a fishing boat, they would dive on that boat, and hell, they wouldn't miss it 100 feet, check it out, supposedly. And that's I don't know whether they went to Taiwan or whether they went to China with them.
Yeah, so these are B-24s that yeah. we're done with because World War II is over,
yeah.
but Chiang Kai-shek is still going at it and can use some B-24s.
Yeah.
And you were the guy that had to go up with them and make sure everything was working.
That's right.
What does it feel like to dive on a fishing boat and come within 100 feet?
Well, the first time, I wondered what the hell's going on.
So you never experienced combat, but you had in your own way contributed to the Allied victory in World War II. You came home to California. You met your wife, Eva. Your brother, Floyd, who had served in the Army in Europe during the war, was back home too. And you two brothers went to work farming this land you grew up on. But Mother Nature didn't really cooperate.
Oh, it was tough. We had citrus, 20 acres of lemons, froze 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
And so my brother says, shall we pull them out? So we pulled all those lemons out and planted oranges. What do you know? It come and killed the little orange trees the next year, 3 years in a row in the late 40s. We had cold weather and never had cold weather for a long time after that. But it was just a cycle. That went against us, and that's how come I became a barber for 20-some years.
Yeah, so there's probably a few folks listening right now who got a haircut or two from you, and I know there are a whole lot of tree fruit growers who bought more than a few of your innovative tree props. Some folks might not know what we're talking about, so can you explain that to us? What is a tree prop?
Well, a tree prop is like 1 by 2 by 10 or 12 feet. And it goes underneath the limbs of the peaches or plums or whatever to hold the limbs up when they get heavy with the fruit. When the season's over, you gather them up and save them for another year.
Forever, people have been propping up limbs, but they'll just find, you know, I got an 8-foot piece of 1 by 2. I'll stick that in there. Oh, no, I need 10 feet for this. There's no adjustable nature to this tree prop, right? It's just a piece of wood. So you thought, what if we could make them adjustable?
We made a metal hook that would slide over it with gouges on it. And when the pressure come on the limb, it would make it tight. It wouldn't slide up down the... They made them already, but nobody had a good one. So we developed this good one.
What made you think you could make it better?
You put the hook on there, maybe sometimes they wouldn't catch on and slide. They'd slide, the limb would break or something other like that. I had all the big farmers in the country and the little ones too.
Does that seem like a big deal to you, what you did with those props and the amount of fruit you probably saved by producing those?
Well, I guess it was, actually.
That's what I'm thinking about. Tell me if I'm wrong, but isn't the implication here that by designing and marketing a better tree prop, you saved a ton of fruit, not just to put money in the farmers' pockets who are growing it, but to feed people. There's a lot of plums and pluots and apricots and peaches and nectarines that got eaten that would have gone to waste.
Yeah, that's right.
And we're probably talking millions, right?
Oh, yeah.
Easily.
Yeah.
Yeah, over decades.
Yeah.
And pretty much every farmer listening right now on the radio has used one of your tree props.
Well, that's right. And also, we used to raise citrus nursery, too.
Mm-hmm.
We got orange trees all over around there.
You have had quite an impact, and you're still going strong at 93. I know you recently went to the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight, and I'm sure you heard these two words a few times on that journey, but I want to say them too. Thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thanks for your time today. And I do have one more question. As a member of what's been called the greatest generation, what does America represent to you? For those of us who are younger, and you do have children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, what do we all need to understand about America?
Well, here, if you work, you can get ahead. If you don't work, you're not getting ahead. My theory is you better pick out something you'd like to do and do that. If you like it, you'll make it.
Good advice from Roy Kottner, 93 years young. You'll find photos of Roy in action at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And you're also going to find links to the ongoing effort by a World War II prisoner of war who's making a difference in the lives of today's returning veterans. We're going to hear about that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.